Hello, and welcome to episode 47 of The Ethical Life, a place where each week we talk about the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, social media manager for Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined as always by Rick Kite, who is the head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
Good to see you. Tyrone Scambotti, writing in Greater Good magazine, asks what I think is an important question. How do you know if you're actually humble? Rick, in today's polarized world, where everyone seemingly feels a need to have an opinion about almost everything, it seems like humility is underappreciated. Do you agree?
Absolutely. It's vastly underappreciated. And part of the problem, I think, as Tyrone Scambotti recognizes in his article, is it's really hard to do self-assessments of humility. It's generally something we only know because others can let us know whether we're actually humble, because we find out from our interaction with other people. And we're so full of biases when it comes to evaluations of our own conduct and our own beliefs that it's very hard for us to know where we stand with regard to this particular virtue.
And in a minute here, we'll talk for a few minutes about Tyrone's suggestions about how to evaluate your own humility. And we'll talk about the column you wrote that really focuses on this. But before we get to either of those points, I just think we need to spend a minute, again, reinforcing why this is such an important, is it safe to call it a virtue?
Oh, yes, it's absolutely a virtue. But, you know, it's significant that not all cultures regard it as a virtue. The ancient Greeks, for example, never listed humility as a virtue. In fact, Aristotle considered pride to be a virtue. Of course, he meant something different by pride than we tend to think. What he meant by pride is kind of I think we'd probably call it something like self-confidence. Which, of course, that is very, self-confidence is quite important, and kind of an accurate assessment of one's own abilities and then the kind of persistence and willingness to try new things, that sort of thing, is really quite important. And so you don't want to underestimate your abilities or have false modesty. There's really two kinds of orientations that societies have. One orients its moral evaluations around the concept of guilt, and the other type orients them around shame. Shame is in which we evaluate our own conduct in reference to the opinions of others. And so we either take pride in how we are doing because others value us highly, or we are ashamed of our conduct. And so we're always judging ourselves in response to others' opinions. In a guilt culture, we evaluate our conduct with regard to some standard. For example, a society that highly values truth will say, like, I regard my own conduct as good if I'm honest and truthful, but not if I'm deceptive. Well, that's a different kind of standard, because people might, in my social circle, want me to say things that aren't true and have a higher opinion of me if I go along with their beliefs, whether I believe them or not, and punish me for disagreeing them if that's what I really believe. So you can see where there's a difference in the two.
It does. And that sounds to me like, and is there some overlap between humility and possibly courage?
Yes, quite a bit. Because oftentimes where you need courage is where you have to stand up to the demands of others and take some kind of a risk. And so courage, especially in social situations, is quite important. And this is oftentimes when we speak of politicians having courage or various public figures, it's because they make a stand on principle despite, you know, like what might reward them in the populace eyes. The reason humility in that sort of culture is so important is because it allows one to evaluate oneself according to an independent standard, and then especially if one part of that standard is truthfulness, you're much more likely to have kind of a proper understanding of the way the world is and how you stand in relation to the world if you have the virtue of humility, because you're more likely to ask questions and serious questions.
And that's a little bit what I think Tyrone Scambotti wrote in his piece, and we'll certainly link to that in the show notes. But he focuses maybe a little more narrowly on what he calls intellectual humility. And I think we've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but we seem to live in a world where everybody, or many people, seem to think they have to have an opinion on just about every issue, especially the ones that people are talking about. And when I'm talking to somebody and ask their opinion about one of those issues, and they just start telling me how nuanced that issue is and how it's maybe not as easy to have a solid opinion as maybe others do, gosh, that to me says a lot of good things about that person, but maybe not everybody feels that way. And in his piece, when he writes about intellectual humility, he encourages people to think about when they have an opinion, whether they're open to changing it. Because I think too often we get so locked into our ideas and our beliefs that we aren't thinking nearly enough about whether we're right, especially if new evidence comes along.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. We ought to be quite open to new opinions. We ought to become comfortable with questioning our own ideas. The only reliable way I know to do that is to develop friends with people who have permission to question your beliefs and like give you a hard time once in a while when you're being stubborn or you're not really forthright with your answers.
But don't we live, or many of us at least, live in a world where that happens less than it used to, because we so often surround ourselves by people who think like we do, or maybe don't have the courage to tell us when they think we might be wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, we're kind of changing the structures of society in which it's becoming much easier for me to form relationships of my own choosing, which often then turn out to be the ones that I'm more comfortable with, which are less challenging to me. And this is really, it's really hard for me then to develop humility within that kind of context. And the problem with that is that we get stupider and stupider because we get more and more comfortable with the way we see things, not even recognizing that some of the things that we believe, oftentimes many of them, are false or at least partly false. Right? It's very hard to have the complete truth about anything going on in the world that's somewhat complex.
And the other point that really jumped out to me in Tyrone's column was, when we do find ourselves in a situation with a close friend or like a spouse, he talks about looking at how we approach their perspective. Are we willing to hear their perspective in good faith, or do we simply insist they must all have it wrong? I think because we don't find ourselves in those situations, or maybe because of sort of the downsides of social media, we've become, I think, in many cases, much less good at listening to others.
So, and see, this is one of the things that Robert Greenleaf talks a lot about when he writes about servant leadership, is like the one of the chief characteristics of a really good leader, which he calls a servant leader, is the capacity to listen. He doesn't mean kind of a superficial listening. He means paying very close attention to what people are saying and trying to understand why they're saying it, which often isn't easy because not everybody's very articulate about what they believe or what they're feeling at the time. But if you really want to understand what's going on in an organization, you have to know what's going through people's heads. And can I share a story with you about this?
Yeah, please do.
So Dave Scogan, who's the founder of Festival Foods, which is a pretty big grocery store chain in Wisconsin, he tells the story of how he was, you know, he had opened up a few stores. This was early in his career of, you know, really expanding his grocery business, and thought he was doing really well because he's a real take charge kind of person, and also works really hard. He pays a lot of attention to his competitors, putting in all kinds of innovations and different things. And he thought he was doing really well. And he hired this consultant because he'd heard him speak on servant leadership. This consultant's name was Jim Hunter. And Jim Hunter said, the first thing you have to do is a 360 evaluation. Like you can't determine whether you are a good leader or not. You have to find out what other people think of you. So there was a series of questions. He got to, you know, all the people that were reporting to him. And he compared his own evaluations of himself with the evaluations of others. And he had scored himself pretty high on listening, like 8 out of 10 or 7 out of 10, something like that. The people reporting to him scored him about 2. And he was shocked by this. And goes to his wife and he says, I can't believe it. Nobody thinks that I listen. And she says, I could have told you that. Like, but you don't listen. I mean, that's the problem. So what he did is he went and took several pairs of white shirts that he wore every day at the company and had the word listen embroidered on the cuff. So whenever he looked down, he would remind himself that he needs to shut up and pay attention to what other people are saying. And sometimes, you know, like we don't know how bad we are at, especially at paying close attention to other people. And the way to do it is we need to make some behavioral change in ourselves to kind of force us to do that.
That's got to be tough to do. And you know, there's the instance you relay about the grocery store owner. But, you know, I've always had a tough time sort of deciding what things we can change about ourselves and what things are just sort of baked into who we are. And I think, and my sort of belief has been that because all of us are a mix of things that we do well and things we don't do as well, that I think the tendency is to spend more time trying to fix the things that aren't good at, and that we should spend more time trying to improve at the things we are good at. But it sounds like in this case, he did just the opposite, and maybe I'm looking at this all wrong. So I will listen and take the courage and humility to listen to your response to see what you think of that approach. I mean, how do you determine things that you can change about yourself and do better on, and the things that maybe you can't, or is everything fungible?
No, I think in general, that's very good advice to work really hard on the things that you can actually make improvements on, which tend to be the things you already do fairly well, but make them better. And don't put too much energy in trying to correct the things that you're already not very good at, except there are some crucial characteristics that are absolutely essential for our lives to go well. And especially if we're in a leadership role, for our organization or group or community to do well. And listening is one of them, because humility is so important. And so if we're not very good at humility, we have no choice but to try to get better. Because if we're not, this is the problem. You know, the old saying, pride goes before a fall. The reason pride goes before a fall is because the person who is proud, who doesn't have humility, who doesn't really pay attention to others, has a false picture of what's going on in their lives and in the world around them. And that's stupidity. And if you're leading out of stupidity or ignorance, you're gonna cause real problems. And if you're in a leadership role, it's not going to be just problems for yourself, it's going to be problems for others. This is one of the things I'm concerned about with our nation as we move to a culture that does not value humility very much, because we're in the midst of a pretty rapid shift from a traditionally guilt culture to a shame culture. And a shame culture doesn't value humility. A culture like that gets more and more stupid.
You know, you obviously feel humility is a pretty important virtue. And not surprisingly, that was something you chose to write about in a bit more detail in your column, which we'll certainly link to. But you set that up in kind of an interesting way, where you looked at three people across three generations and kind of took a snapshot of their lives. And maybe you can talk a little bit about why you think living a good life requires humility.
As I was thinking about humility, I was first just going to write in some ways kind of traditionally about it, why we have to think more about humility and put into place practices that can help us, say, be better listeners and ask more questions and so forth. But I think you're exactly right. It's really hard for us to do that. It's really hard for us to change things we don't do well. And I started thinking about, like, why is it that we don't value humility as much as previous generations? Because my generation and I know my kids' generation talks about humility much less than, say, my parents or grandparents did. When you ask them if they think it's a virtue, they have very much different opinions. By the way, I ask my students every year, like, to name the virtues of the people they most admire and describe them. Humility hardly ever comes up. They don't see it. Even though I think it's practiced by many of the people that they do admire, they don't see it and name it in the same way. And I was thinking, this has to do with the different kind of world that we're living in. We don't have the kinds of social structures in place that situate us in a community in which we are continually being asked questions about what we know and how we know it and whether we are living up to the standards that we profess.
And I don't want to just stop there for a second, because you say it's something that people don't talk about as much as they used to. And what I constantly hear, and it's probably I hear it because every time I hear it, I just wince, is when someone is elevated to a high role. Maybe there's somebody who's named the CEO of a company, or someone wins a big election that's going to maybe propel them into great things, or somebody just gets recognized in some way. And they're giving a speech about what it's like to take on this new role. They'll start off sometimes by saying that this overwhelming victory makes them feel humble. And I just never quite believe them. It just seems like that is not it seems to me like that's just something they're thinking they have to say. If you have worked your butt off for 9 months trying to win a Senate race and you trounce your opponent and you stand up there in front of your supporters who are cheering you on and you say, well, tonight I will humbly go and serve as your senator. Do you believe folks when they say that, or is that just sort of performative?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's performative. I think it goes over well, and it seems to me it's something like some kind of a statement about, oh, I don't really deserve it, at the same time that you received overwhelming evidence by receiving the award that you do deserve it.
And in politics, they probably have not spent the last 9 months talking about how humble they are. They've probably been spending the last 9 months telling voters why they are great. And now, once voters apparently agree, then they pull out the humble card and say, well, actually, let me tell you, I'm really a humble guy. And that just never rings true.
Yeah. And our politics really doesn't award humility and reward humility in the way that we ought to, because a humble person is really focused on whatever it is they're committed to. They're generally focused on some cause or, you know, some good end they're trying to achieve, or the well-being of others. And they're not really thinking about self-assessment at the time they're focused on those things. And it's not that people who are humble, they don't talk about they tend not to think they are humble themselves. And most humble people, if you would tell them that they're humble, they'll deny it. They'll give you evidence of all kinds of other people that they think really are humble. But the difference is they can tell you specific circumstances of, like, why this or that person is humble. It shows that they're paying attention to it and they value it. They just don't see it in themselves. That's actually a pretty good marker of humility.
I think it's even the supporters of Donald Trump would admit he was not an especially humble person and doesn't seem to remain to be very humble. And obviously, yeah, that all he won a presidential race not being a humble guy. If you look back in history, though, another one-term president, Jimmy Carter, in this case, does then and still to this day seems like a humble man. But I think many people look at the reason he was a one-term president was he was looked on as weak. I don't think there's a lot of comparisons between Donald Trump and Jimmy Carter, but Donald Trump certainly took the tack that America wanted a strong and confident leader. Who do you think resonates more with Americans? Someone who truly is humble or someone who at least portrays a sense of strength and power?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious the person who portrays more strength and power.
But I mean, they're both, I mean, I'll remind you, they're both in each of these cases, they were one-term presidents.
Yeah. And I think like a person of humility is much more likely to surround themselves by people like, for example, in the cabinet, people who would disagree with them. So somebody like Abraham Lincoln, who appoints people who are political rivals, knowing that to keep the Union together, the only way is to really know what's going on, not from his own point of view or the point of view of his party. And he's got to lead out of those kinds of that kind of conflict and the contradictions that arise from that. That's a really rare quality. One of the problems we have in a democracy is that we want our politicians to be continually campaigning, which means selling themselves. And a person of humility has a very hard time doing that. And so I think we have all kinds of people in our nation that would be really good leaders who never put themselves forward for it. And so one of the questions is how do we discover them and promote them?
And you know, no, I think it's probably safe to say nobody listening to this show is going to be president one day. But there are people listening to this show right now who are going to be leaders in their companies, in their communities. And I think the tricky part for those people, it would seem to me, is to say, yes, I believe humility is important for all the reasons you've just talked about. At the same time, I think I'm uniquely qualified to lead this community, this organization, this group of people. Can both those things be true? Or I guess they can be true, but how does a person who thinks that kind of square those two beliefs?
Well, see, this it often happens in different kinds of organizations where kind of leadership potential and is recognized in somebody and they're put forward. They'll have a supervisor or something says, you really have potential that you didn't recognize. You need to apply for this other position. So they're kind of pushed forward by others and their qualities are recognized and valued and appreciated and they move up. And this happens in the public sphere as well. And people are recognized. They maybe they serve for a city council. Others recognize that they're doing really good work, that they're listened to, they're respected, that they're good at coalition building, that sort of thing. And they don't think of themselves moving up, but others suggest they do. And so they think, well, somebody needs to do that kind of job. Why don't I run for state legislature? And so we do have people like that who move their way up the ladder in public office. I don't think it happens enough. And I think partly this is one of the problems we have with how we finance political campaigns. And so that's another discussion. But we can tell that something's gone terribly wrong when we have a president right now with Joe Biden with record low approval ratings. And yet in the recent polls, it still shows him beating Donald Trump in a hypothetical race between the two. How can you have somebody that is, the historically low approval ratings by the public who would also defeat the only other, candidate from the other party? It shows like we are somehow putting forth people for our top positions who do not have any humility at all. I don't think anybody would say Joe Biden or Donald Trump have ever in their entire lives been people of humility. And yet, I think that accounts also for a lot of the mistakes that that both have made.
Before we close, I just wanted to pivot back for a moment to your column, and I'll let folks kind of learn when they read it, the sort of the characters you develop, but sort of you conclude, and you've touched on this earlier in our conversation, where you think people a generation or two ago were better at being humble than many people are today. How optimistic are you that that is cyclical and that a generation or two in the future will sort of recapture that virtue? And what do we need to do to better our chances for that to happen?
I'm becoming less optimistic about it, you know, because I at one point I thought it was cyclical in the sense that you have, you know, generations develop, you know, come to recognize there's a certain kind of lack among the previous generation that they're observing in power, so that they cultivate it in themselves. But humility is cultivated within organizations in which people are mutually accountable to one another. And the problem we're seeing is that each generation has less belonging to the kinds of social organizations. These are established organizations in which you develop relationships among a circle of acquaintances who will hold you accountable for your thoughts and actions. And one of the examples I cite in my column is the grandmother in this story grew up in a church, for one, in a large family taking care of her siblings, but also in a church in which she, you know, weekly participated in a kind of these rituals in which everybody is asking one another how they are doing in relationship to their own standards. But this happens in other kinds of organizations too. It happens in service organizations. It happens for kids in organizations like scouting and in you know, 4-H, things like that. And because we're seeing the gradual dissolution of all kinds of these voluntary associations or service organizations, that's why I'm remaining pessimistic. Now, if we can recover that, I will be much more optimistic about the future. And maybe we can, but I don't think it works to just say, okay, we need a certain character trait. I think we need to structure our lives differently.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. And I think this is the second time, by the way, I have made you the star third baseman for the New York Yankees. But once again, you are the star third baseman for the New York Yankees, and you're one of the most talented and best paid players in Major League Baseball. Your team is about to face the Boston Red Sox, its biggest rival, but your wife has a baby the morning before the first game of the series. Do you take maternity leave like many MLB players are now allowed to do, or do you put your job on the field first?
I put my most important job first, and that's being a father and a husband. So I take the leave.
And you, that seems like a pretty easy decision for you.
Very easy decision. And two things. The Boston Red Sox, if they're wise, they insist on it, because what they're going to do is they're going to end up with a player who has more.
First of all, you're with the Yankees.
Well, that changes it. The Boston Red Sox would criticize it, but the Yankees would say, good, that's going to make you long-term. You're going to be a better player. There's proven mental health benefits that come from that. But most importantly, you know, parental leave is such an important thing for society. We take sports figures and they become in some ways symbols of what we believe in and what we don't believe in for the rest of us, right? And that's why it's so important for these players and for the teams to champion ideas like parental leave, because children who have the great benefit of growing up in stable families with two parents have much better chances of success doing well in life later on. Parental leave early on, right away, and a lot of of leave, not just a few days, but 2 weeks or more, preferably, you know, like 10 to 15 weeks, is going to really increase the odds of that couple having a stable relationship a year or two later, and of the child doing well.
You know, a couple of things on this. One, this was, I think in the Major League Baseball's case, this is, I think, only a 2 or 3 or 4 day leave, not as long as, you know, maybe you would think it could be. But what caught my eye on this is, this has not been around in Major League Baseball that long. And there was a short story I read from the New York Post that pointed out that when a player, and I forget who, but it doesn't really matter, took parental leave recently, like everybody's like, okay, great. You know, see you in a few days, everything's fine. But like, even 9, 10 years ago, these players who did the same thing were like getting beat up on sports talk radio and really criticized for doing this by saying, you know, with comments like, well, these are, you know, people who are making, you know, millions and millions of dollars, and this is, they should put the fans first, and what are they thinking? And there really seems to have been, over the past 10 years or so, an attitude change, not only in the sport, but maybe with the fans as well, that this just simply is okay. And we often look to our sports figures as being role models. You know, maybe this is one other small way they can be a role model.
Yes, I absolutely. And if they're going to be role models, then take it seriously. And I mean, the other thing, you know, I don't know this, I'm just speculating, but I suspect that taking parental leave and encouraging, say a couple of weeks, not just a day or two, but a couple of weeks of parental, I mean, that can be a big loss for a team. And we're not talking about playoffs here. We're just talking about during the season, right?
162 game season.
Yep, that's a long season. And if it's a player that you have some investment in, you want them to be at peak performance when they are on the field. There's all these studies that show, like, two parents who take parental leave together early on, the mother and the baby end up sleeping much better. There's much less incidence of postpartum depression for the mother. You know, and these are things that are going to have long-term effects. So if you have a player that doesn't take leave and you have postpartum depression by the mother, or you don't have a stable relationship between the parents, that's going to affect on-field performance. I mean, so, you know, of course, you don't know, like, what does that translate into in terms of wins on the field and so forth. But we have a real problem here with all kinds of players getting involved in, you know, domestic violence and, you know, emotional issues. And let's take a, you know, step back a little bit, take a little bit bigger picture and say, well, so what are the things that we can do to actually have our players live a healthy life, have good relationships for our team, but then also serve as role models for society?
I just want to stretch out this dilemma a little bit further, just to get your reaction. You know, one, if this is you're again star third baseman for the Yankees, and you and your wife are really wanting to have a family, would part of that discussion be saying, hey, like, in an ideal world, you know, having the kid born in November or December or January or even February is going to be a whole lot better than other times of the year, because, you know, although I'll be having to do some stuff, I won't be on the road 81 games a year. Would you try to kind of plan things better so you could have that child during the off season, or would that even be part of your calculus?
It would certainly be part of my calculus, and because you're thinking about what's going to be best for us as a family long term. And so there's going to be more time for that bonding. First of all, for the parents, their relationship and having good relationship, it's really dependent on managing these times of real difficulty coming through them together. So that's really important, but also the bonding time with the child. And so every aspect of parenting and how we can do that best, that has to be part of the discussion.
And then finally, last question on this is, again, everything's the same. You're the Yankees third baseman, but instead of about to face a regular season series with the Red Sox, your wife goes into labor the morning of the first game of the World Series. What do you do about that? And I should stipulate, of course, you're playing in the World Series. If you're not playing in the World Series, it's a very easy decision. But you're playing in the World Series, and wife goes into labor, and what do you do? And maybe you even planned it. Maybe you're expecting her to go into labor in November, but she goes a few weeks early because
that can happen. No, it can happen. I mean, it's really tough. Now, here's the sort of thing where I think it's really important on the relationship between the spouses and what they decide. And I think teams have to be respectful of that decision, but I think that's the sort of thing that you start talking about well in advance, and you talk it over and you reach an understanding together.
But the fans, are the ones who are going to have that reaction. And should that even play, or many fans will have a bad reaction. Should that even play into that decision?
No, but I think your responsibility to your teammates does play into it. And so that's, and who, like if you're the star player, you probably don't have a backup that's going to give you the same chances of winning, right? If you're out, this is the sort of thing where, you know, being able to have a good relationship in which you talk about it. And I think a lot of it depends on what is the emotional support for the mother. Say, you say, if I can't be there, is she going to have her mother there, for example? And is her mother a good support? You know, is there somebody else that can take my place there, and am I going to be the sort of person that's going to, like, the off season's coming up really soon, am I going to spend then, you know, several months where I'm really playing a strong role at home? So that's the sort of thing that would go into that discussion.
Well, Rick, I will hope that if indeed you are the star third baseman of the New York Yankees unexpectedly later in your career, you will continue to host the Ethical Live podcast with me, at least in the off season.
Well, you can tell Scott that I'm the sort of person who has never had to make a decision like that.
Well, as a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Chris Lay is Lee's podcast operation manager. Please subscribe to the Ethical Life on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. And be sure to check out Rick's column about humility on all Lee newspaper websites. For Rick Kite, I'm Scott Rada. Thank you for joining us.